The history of television is a history of failure.
For every television series that lasted years and years, there were dozens that lasted only one season or less.
But did they deserve to die? Or were they canceled too soon?
Everybody, and welcome back to Canceled Too Soon, the podcast where we review television series that lasted only one season or less. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibel.
Okay, save that for Scary-tober.
Oh, fine. But we're doing a horror show.
We are doing a horror show.
First of all, we're back. That's nice.
So the last couple of months here, Critically Acclaimed, we've been sort of doing some shuffling and reorganizing, and we've dropped a couple of shows. We've created some new stuff. We've moved some things around on the Patreon. And we're basically trying to find a schedule that really works for us right now, now that things are changing a little bit. Society is opening up, then closing down again, and kids are out of school, and kids are back in school, and who the hell can keep up with all of it? So we've been trying, and it's been difficult to be on top of every single thing, but Cancel Too Soon is our pride and joy.
Yeah, this was sort of the thing that started it all.
Yeah. On our own, anyway.
That is our own thing. We were doing podcasts for other people.
Yeah, but this was ours.
No
one else believed in this crap. We pitched this around, and nobody wanted it.
Yeah, I pitched the podcast idea to more than one outlet, and they all turned it down. But so this became ours, and as you've probably noticed, we haven't been able to keep up with it with the same regularity that we once did, and we're going to try to get back to that when we can.
Yep.
For now, we are coming back at you with something that ties in to something very topical.
Yeah, you know, we were going to plan to do a TV series called They Came From Outer Space, which it turns out is shockingly long.
It's a single season, but it was a really long season.
And it was an hour-long show, which I'd forgotten about, so it's just been really difficult with all the other programming and all the other stuff that we're doing to cram that one in. So I think for the foreseeable future, Cancel Too Soon is going to be a bit more freewheeling. It's going to be whatever we can fit into our schedules for a little bit. We might have it be a little less planned in advance. We'll just do an episode whenever we can. But yeah, this one felt like we really had to do this. There is a new series of films that we've been reviewing on the Critically Acclaimed podcast. We review new movies based on R.L. Stine's Fear Street books.
Yeah, and we reviewed all three of the films on Critically Acclaimed. And as we stated over there, neither of us are R.L. Stine readers.
No, I've read a few here and there, but not many.
I have not cracked an R.L. Stine book. R.L. Stine is a little after my time. I was already delving into like really gory horror shit by the time R.L. Stine was really good. Yeah, but
same. For a lot of people in like the 90s in particular, he was a gateway.
Yeah, R.L. Stine was training wheels for like real horror. He did really popular horror for kids, where scary things happened, but not like haunted house level kind of scary
nothing stuff. Nothing grotesquely violent. Yeah. Usually nothing terrible happened that couldn't be undone. There was death. There was occasionally some genuine scare in it. But all things considered, pretty tame. Nothing that most schools wouldn't be comfortable having in the library section.
But as with all horror for kids, if you're into it, it feels kind of subversive.
Sure.
Even when you're a little kid, you find some horror movie like what was one I watched as a kid, like Mr. Boogity,
which is a
TV movie. That one felt like really, I shouldn't have been watching it, even though it's totally playful and very easy for kids.
That's how I felt about The Monster Squad, which is actually pretty edgy for kids, but it was still definitely a kid's movie.
Yeah, there's like sex gags, but
sex gags. There's some people get staked through the heart. There's a werewolf that blows up. It's a pretty severe PG-13, but it's still definitely a PG-13.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess The Monster Squad came along right when It was part of this big trend where there were a lot of movies about kids, but the kids themselves were, like, kind of messy assholes.
Mm-hmm.
Like Goonies, E.T., kids with messy rooms, essentially, who cussed at each other. I'm not really sure what kind of ushered in. I guess it was all just part of a trend of continuing this trend of horror for kids. I think R.L. Stine spearheaded this big movement to open up a lot more horror properties for kids.
Yeah. R.L. Stine, he wasn't just writing books for them. He was a brand.
Yeah.
Did you read the new R.L. Stine? There's a new R.L. Stine at the bookstore, and there'd be cardboard standee with like a big green scary mask in it or something. And
I don't know if he has yet... like sourced out his name, like there
to other people, like
the Tom Clancy or the VC Andrews, where there's ghost writers. I think R.L. Stine still writes all of his own work. If the idea of him outsourcing his name to other authors is at all offensive, I dearly apologize.
We don't know all the details.
I don't know the details.
What I do appreciate is that R.L. Stine is a figure who has managed to become a world famous author, writing scary stories for children. That is not something most people do. And I really appreciated the way, the first live-action Goosebumps movie where Jack Black played R.L. Stine. They don't look anything alike, but he was fun. They had built up this sort of weird mythos where he's this like reclusive author and nobody knows where he is. And they moved in next to R.L. Stine, and it turns out all of his books are magic and they're keeping monsters in. And there was he has this whole like weird... rivalry with Stephen King over who's selling more books. And R.L. Stine's like, last I checked, I was way ahead. I don't know how true that is. I wouldn't be shocked. He's huge.
Stephen King only has the edge in that he started publishing earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how close they are in age.
I think R.L. Stine's more prolific in many respects. Yeah, they can crank them out. They're not very long books, for the most part.
The conceit of the movie was about the real-life R.L. Stine, and all of the monsters in his books were real, and in this wrinkle very much akin to Wes Craven's New Nightmare, he could physically contain the monsters in a story.
Yeah.
And if you cracked open the book, the monster would physically manifest and appear in the real world and wreak havoc.
That first Goosebumps movie is really good.
It's really funny.
It's a rock solid. I would have loved, that would have been my favorite movie for a while when I was a kid. Like, I was a huge fan. The sequel, Haunted Halloween, it's kind of more the same, but it's pretty good.
It's got some fun monster stuff, but the characters in the story aren't that interesting.
But all of those were very, very much, even those movies and the Goosebumps TV series, which is more of an anthology, Tales from the Crypt kind of Are You Afraid of the Dark kind of vibe, they're all pretty good. But they're all definitely geared more towards kids. And his Fear Street books, and I never read these, were allegedly geared a bit more towards the teens. You know, people who can handle a bit more violence, a bit more terror.
Goosebumps might be for like around age 8. And from what I understand, Fear Street was like 12 or 13.
In fact, so you can handle some of the more more severe horror. And so Lee Janiak, the director of Honeymoon, got the really sweet gig to adapt not only Fear Street to the screen, but to do a trilogy.
Three Fear Street films.
Three live action films shot simultaneously, telling all one story. But over the course of three different time periods. Mm. And originally they were planned for theatrical release. I'm not sure how exactly the shift came over. But then they moved to Netflix, which earlier this month released one per week.
Uh-huh.
And again, we reviewed all of these on Critically Acclaimed. We can go into great detail over there. But I'm just going to say it. Instant classic.
They're very, very good movies. And I highly recommend all three of them.
Yeah.
They're just fun.
One second. Luca, get off the counter, buddy. Look at him. He's just waving his butt at us. Luca!
I just see his bottom.
Damn it, buddy.
Yeah, the Lee Janiak films, however, were clearly courting a much older audience because these are R-rated films, and we know the secret about R-rated films. Teenagers go to see them anyway.
Of course.
Especially now that they're on Netflix, anybody has access to them.
Yeah, that
much.
Was the gag. Like, maybe your local movie theater wouldn't let you see the latest Friday the 13th movie, but it's going to be on HBO within a year.
Or the people working at the theater don't give a damn, and you're going to get to go anyway.
My point is, worst case scenario, eventually it's going to be on cable or basic cable, and you're going to see it, and no one cares anymore. Here, it just goes straight to Netflix. Doesn't matter. You're going to see it right away. Yeah, Luca, seriously, get off the... What is your deal tonight, Luca? He's been so good for months.
I remember Roger Ebert pointed out one of those one of the main hypocrisies of the R rating was that most R-rated films, at least when he was about the time he was writing this, were R-rated films that were meant to appeal to younger audiences.
Yeah.
You know, like your Friday the 13th and your Nightmares on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Those are for teens to go see and have a good time in the dark and, you know, get scared and make out and eat popcorn. Whereas, like, films that were actually for adult audiences that dealt with, like, adult themes and maybe had some sexuality in them, like, also rated R? Like, he saw that there was a little bit of a hypocrisy there, and, you know, there was this big discussion as to what
the irony
about
is
the
that
rating.
Films and TV that are made for mature audiences are often made for immature audiences.
But in 1998, they took Fear Street on a dry run.
Yeah. Before the movies, where the live-action movies were a twinkle in anyone's eye, we ended up having a failed primetime pilot for a Fear Street television series. It aired. It didn't do great in the ratings, but I didn't know about it until really, really recently. So let's take a look at the early failed, but was it really canceled too soon, attempt, R.L. Stine's Ghosts of Fear Street.
Hey, PJ. I've been waiting for you. What's wrong with you? My science project got a little out of hand. You know how they say on TV, don't try this at home, kids. Well, I tried it.
What happened to them?
You'll find out soon enough.
Ghosts of Fear Street is not like the movies. This is a show for kids. And
the prime time, but prime time in the sort of Full House, Boy Meets World kind of demographic. Yeah.
And this one has an approach of something a little bit more like the Munsters or the Addams Family, in that it's about a cast of characters who move into a really weird neighborhood, and weird stuff is going to happen there. And for the most part, they're all kind of interested or okay with weird shit. It's about a family, dad, mom, three kids.
The Murphy family. Let's go through the cast here. The father is named PJ Murphy. He's played by Christopher Rich, who's
R.L. Stine.
Who is essentially R.L. Stine. You may remember him from the sitcom Reba. He was on Boston Legal for a while. He was in the Joy Luck Club. He grew up on Fear Street, an actual street, and in the years that followed, he became a writer of young adult horror, all of which, it turns out, we'll find out later in the episode, were directly inspired by his actual experiences growing up on the street.
Yeah, and it opens with a flashback to 1972, and it's a scary story of him going into the bad house on the block, and he's going to hang out with friends, and when he goes in, everything's coated with, like, spider webbing and, like, sticky gross stuff.
And he doesn't notice that the parents are, like, desiccated, and their eyes have popped out.
Everybody's all, like, mummified and cocooned as he walks through the house, but he doesn't notice all that.
He finds all of his friends, and they're playing Twister, but they're, like, mummified in place, and then finally, the little kid he was there to see says, "Hey, you know when they say don't try this at home?
I tried it at home.
And then he, like, turns into a bug creature and starts shooting webbing out of his armpits, which glow red for some reason. And that part I don't understand.
Well, he's got, like, little buggy, like, web-spinning apertures under his arms.
I guess, but it's weird that it's in his pit.
He sprays out of his armpits.
Yeah.
Cocoons his friend, and then his head turns into a fly head. Yeah. And he says, "I'm gonna suck your blood with this flexi straw."
And then he whips out a bendy straw. Mm. And at that point, PJ Murphy's two kids are like, "A bendy straw? Really?
That's not threatening, Dad.
That's not really threatening." So he sticks to his guns, though. He insists the bendy straw is threatening. We meet PJ Murphy's wife, Anne, is played by Talia Balsam. Talia Balsam was on Mad Men.
She's got a long TV career.
Yeah, she's probably best known lately for Mad Men, but she's in Divorce. She's been in a lot of stuff. She was on Without a Trace for a while. We've also got their kids.
She was also married to George Clooney.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
And if you say so. And I think she also, like, married one of her Mad Men co-stars.
If you say so. Then they've got two kids. They've got Joe, played by Vincent Barry. Vincent Barry was in stuff like Big Mama's House 2 and Breakdown and Free Willy 3, The Rescue. Then they've got their oldest daughter, Kit.
Typical teenage daughter.
She's played by Alexandra Breckenridge, who still working. She was on This Is Us for a long time, so you probably recognize her. She was on The Walking Dead for a while, so she's had a pretty big TV career too. And then the littlest kid in the family is Mickey, played by Cameron Finley. Cameron Finley played Beaver in Leave It to Beaver, the movie from 1997. He was also on Baywatch for a while, apparently.
I never saw that Leave It to Beaver movie.
Nor I.
That's when there were a lot of TV adaptations that were actually like kind of fun and tongue-in-cheek, and they weren't coming out every week.
Yeah.
You know, the... which came first, the Brady Bunch movie or the Addams Family?
Ooh.
For the films.
I think the Addams Family? I think the Addams Family is the one that broke, because there was this trend in the 90s, and people don't really talk about it very much anymore, but there was this trend in the 90s of taking old sitcoms and making big budget, or at least modestly budgeted, studio comedies out of them.
But they tended to be kind of like farcical send-ups of the main material.
Yeah, some more so than others. The Addams Family was already kooky enough as it was, so that one's a relatively straight adaptation, but that first Addams Family movie and the Addams Family Values... They're great.
I love
those such Adams good comedies.
The Barry Sonnenfeld Addams Family movies are really, really good.
And then the Brady Bunch. So that was in 1991, the Addams Family movie. And the Brady Bunch movie was 1995. So I think Addams Family was the one that broke that
kind
door
of
open.
Spearheaded these sitcom adaptations.
The Brady Bunch movie is shockingly high concept. Because at some point they realize that nothing about the Bradys is plausible. And so rather
just as weird as the Addams Family.
So, yeah, and rather than try to create, like, some sort of world where the Brady Bunch was normal, they decided to treat them like the Addams Family, where they're so wholesome, they are so milquetoast, that everyone in the neighborhood is freaked the fuck out by them.
The idea is, in the Brady household looks like it did in the sitcom in the 70s, but it takes place in the 90s, and everybody behaves like it's the 70s, and they don't, like, understand the outside world. But yeah, they're, like, aggressively wholesome, and they, like... Yeah. This is a car, Jack. Oh, of course this is a car. But my name isn't Jack. It's Greg. And this is my sister, Marcia.
Hi!
Yeah. and that freaks out the thief, and the thief runs away.
My favorite one is when all the neighbors are, like, gossiping about the Bradys, and it's like, I was in their bathroom. I didn't see a toilet.
Because you don't see one on sitcom.
You wouldn't see one in a sitcom. It was considered taboo on television. So, yeah, everyone's like, well, they have to have one, right? Where do they keep it?
So, I'm trying to figure out, like, where... like, tracing this back to where we ran off on this tangent, where did, like, sort of the wave of kids' horror begin?
Oh, well, I think there was a wave of kids' horror in the 90s. Mm. And, it's again, this is the sort of thing where it's, like, it's hard to track down specifically.
Yeah.
Because everything has its roots in something else. But at some point in the 90s, we settled on a sort of... mildly creepy episodic television. We had Eerie Indiana, which was a cult favorite.
I've seen some of that.
It mostly very, very good. Are You Afraid of the Dark was a big, one of Nickelodeon's first big, like, original series for, like, older teens.
And I didn't have cable, so I didn't get to see that.
Again, hit or miss, but the hits were really, really good, and a lot of people remember it very, very fondly. And Goosebumps was part of that wave as well. So this is... pretty tightly at the end of that wave.
And of course, the best of the lot, which we covered on Cancel Too Soon, was Bone Chillers, with episodes directed by Richard Elf. It was a weird show. I love Bone Chillers so much.
I appreciate how weird Bone Chillers was. I don't think it was particularly a good show, but I can appreciate its weirdness.
But it's so weird.
I appreciate its weirdness, but if you want to listen to the Bone Chillers episode, you can give a Google search for that. And that's, we did that like a year or two ago.
It's been a while back. But that was also from the mid-90s.
Yeah, so like there's this wave of like horror for kids, but it's not like super duper scary. It's just sort of playing with your fears. And this is very much in the middle of that. It's very, very, you know, sitcom-y.
Yeah.
And it is basically like, what if instead of the Munsters are the only house on the block with monsters in it, what if the Munsters were the only house on the block that didn't have monsters in it? And that's a fun idea.
And so, it's about sort of a I don't want to call them a milquetoast family because they actually are a little bit quirky.
Yeah, no, that's surprisingly well characterized. For a show like this.
They're really quirky, but they are a little out of their element. But they're okay with all of the weird stuff they're running
into.
They're
very wholesome. Yeah. So you got the dad who's he's a bit of a dippy dad, but he's got this secret. He knows all the horror is real. I actually really like the mom, played by Talia Balsam. She grew up on Fear Street, and she was ostracized socially because of it, because Fear Street is a creepy place.
Yeah.
And people who don't live there don't get it. And as a result, she's very eager to put this part of her life behind her and not get her kids involved in it.
Mm.
And over the course of the pilot, she realizes that it actually wasn't that bad, and she starts dealing with her own past. I'm like, that's actually pretty good character development for a pilot for a show like this. The littlest kid, Mickey, he can see ghosts and no one else can. Which at first everyone thinks he's just playing around, and then not only do they realize that he can see their dead grandma, but also he's got a ghost dog who's now the family pet.
To save on having to train an animal that's invisible.
Yeah, which is funny. Yeah.
They did have to add a few special effects for, like, when the dog steps on something, or at the end of the episode, it licks the kid's face, and they use that weird digital smearing technology that just, like, destroyed his face.
It looks awful. We've got the eldest teen, and at first she just seems like kind of like a sardonic, you know, typical rebellious teen, but over the course of the episode, we realize that she's just been feeling really lonely because no one else is as weird as her. And now that she's on Fear Street, everyone's as weird as she wants to be.
Mm.
And she loves it. And she feels calm. And that's really, really nice.
And she instantly has a best friend.
Yeah.
In the form of Cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Azura Sky.
Yeah.
An actress I feel like I only recently discovered Azura Sky with a movie called The Swerve that she starred in last year, where she plays... A woman. It's essentially about it's about a housewife who's suffering the indignities of just everyday life, and how nobody appreciates her, and everybody treats her badly, and how she's sort of constantly teetering on the cusp of just utter despair because of these things that are haunting her. She gives a great performance.
She's been really, really good for a long, long time, and I don't think enough people have noticed. What else you might have seen her in? She was in Wrist Cutters, A Love Story. She was in One Missed Call, the American film. Let's see. She was in. She was in that Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode, Conversations with Dead People, which was considered kind of a big deal when it came out.
Wasn't she like a regular episode. Or semi-regular on?
No,
Buffy,
she was only in two episodes. She was in one episode, and then Conversations with Dead People was like a follow up to it. But that's like her. That was like her like sort of breakout. Everyone's like, "Ooh, who the hell is this? She's good." Mm-hmm. She immediately has a new friend, and then poor Joe, the middle child. He's the one who's actually not super comfortable with all this horror stuff, and his first response is to try to kill it. So when they explore the neighborhood, when they head back to Fear Street to visit their grandfather, played by the great Red Buttons. Red Buttons has been living in Fear Street his whole life. He's run a bed and breakfast, and his wife is dead, and he can't run the place by himself anymore, so he's going to move in with the family and move to San Diego, and it's very bittersweet for him. And the kids explore the neighborhood a little bit, and they find that weird bug house from Dad's story that's covered in all of the spider webs.
Mm.
And that's where they meet Cricket, who lives there, and she collects bugs. And that's when Joe, wanting to leave because he's uncomfortable with all her giant bug collection, runs into the dad downstairs, and they both kind of scare each other in the kitchen because they weren't expecting them to be there. And the dad turns into a giant bug and starts squirting webs out of his armpits and playing with straws.
Joe sees the dad holding a drink and it has two flexi straws in it and they're sticking out like bug antennae and that's the thing that freaks him out.
Yeah.
Is he actually does freak out at bendy straws.
Yeah. So Joe immediately runs home and mom and dad are having a conversation about how, you know, maybe this place isn't so bad. Maybe we can move in here. Mm. You know, it's kind of a nice neighborhood. We're both from here. And
the line of dialogue, the dad says, I can have writer's block anywhere.
As they're having this argument about whether or not they should move back to their old neighborhood, they hear their car alarm go off, and it's like, oh, why is our car alarm going off? Oh, Joe is stealing our car battery. Why is Joe stealing our car battery? Grandpa, do you know anything about this? Oh, yeah, he asked how to kill bugs. And I said a bug zapper would do it. So the next time we see Joe, he's like hooked up a car battery into a backpack and he's put electrified gloves so he can like zap a bug.
It's not gloves. He's got the jumper cables.
Well, he's wearing gloves for protection is my point. So like he looks like he's like an amateur Ghostbuster and he immediately shocks his father. He's like, don't do that again.
He climbs in through the window and just stabs his father right in the chest, electrocuting his own dad. See, I like this. I like this show because, it's like freaky and violent, but playful.
Yeah. No, it's very, very playful. It's really got a great tone to it, which I really like. It's like, it's half kind of like surreal. Like if you remember that show Bone Chillers, which we talked about, everything in Bone Chillers was kind of hyper designed, but in that low budget TV kind of way. So it never really felt real. It felt like a set. But here it's like halfway. It's like half kind of real, half kind of bizarre. So when you're in like the bug guy's house, everything is a little bit more Beetlejuice.
Yeah,
and when you're in like Grandpa's house, it just feels
cockroaches on the background, which good.
It's fun.
Good, production design, but not aiming for realism.
Yeah, and then they go inside the house, and Dad introduces them to his friend PJ, who's been a bug boy since kindergarten.
And they've been best friends since kindergarten.
Yeah, and it's just that it's a condition he deals with. Sometimes it flares up. At the moment, it has, and he just gotta do some breathing exercises, and it'll calm down his blood pressure, and he'll be fine.
He breathes rapidly, and he turns back into a person.
Yeah, he talks about this is the one thing in the episode that bugs me. He talks about like it's like panic attacks, but worse. So once I do some breathing, I'll be fine. And then he immediately hyperventilates. No,
look,
that's not how you do. No,
he's a bug. His biology is different. You don't know how that works.
I don't know how that works, but I do know that for all the people at home who aren't bugs, which I venture to say was probably a lot of their target demo.
Weird. I'll hand you that.
Because that was the thing I had to learn. I suffer from anxiety and I deal with it. And one of the things that I learned was the right way to breathe.
Okay.
When you're breathing when you're having anxiety, when you have a panic attack, or when you hyperventilate, you tend to breathe so fast that you're not actually absorbing the oxygen you're taking into your body. So it just goes in and goes out, and you don't actually get any of the life-saving molecules that you've just brought in, any of the oxygen. So the trick when you are having a panic attack, or when you're even just so stressed you think you might have one, is to breathe in slowly, hold it in, and then breathe out slowly. But your instinct is to breathe really, really quick because you need air. So I learned that the hard way. And my life has dramatically improved. I have so many fewer panic attacks as a result of that. It's really great. Turns out the bug guy is cool. And he's played by Rick Overton from Willow. One of the brownies from Willow.
This bug creature is not the villain. It's not the monster of the week.
Mm-hmm.
He's the neighbor.
Yeah.
He's the neighbor that they're going to be living with.
Yep. Because Cricket is now Kit's best friend. Mm-hmm. They love each other. They think they're the best.
Cricket is caught styling her hair using just the spider webs that are hanging from the walls.
I don't know how intentional this was, but I was watching this with my wife, Bart and Michelle, and there's this moment where Cricket and Kit bond like instantly and completely, and Joe is extremely uncomfortable and wants to leave, and he's like, come on, let's go. And she's like, no, I'm having a moment here. And it really does feel almost like a first queer moment, like where you just finally find your identity a little bit, and you don't know, have to put your finger on it. Kind of genuine,
As somebody who has an older sister, it's also weird when you, because your older siblings behave differently around their friends than they do around you. True. When they find a new friend and they turn into friend sibling, that's kind of alienated for you as their sibling.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But anyway, at the end of the episode, they decide that Mom realizes that the ghost of her grandmother is living there and that living on Fear Street isn't so bad. And so she decides that it's cruel to make Grandpa leave when he has so many roots there. And they decide at the very least they're going to stay there for the summer.
Mm.
And we're going to see how it goes. And and that's Ghosts of Fear Street. It would have been every week, I assume, a new neighbor or a new weird element of Fear Street that would have been monstrous.
Or just, it could have been like an in-home sitcom where it just takes place entirely in that bed and breakfast. There aren't necessarily a lot of
guests would come in. That's, you've already got that built into the premise. It's a bed and breakfast. A guest would come in. Mm. bring some weirdness with them.
Or,
boom.
Or, you know, I'm a dad, I'm having trouble at school. How am I going to remember this test? Well, luckily, our bug friend excretes this substance out of his head. So just take a shot of it, and he takes too much and turns into a bug at school. That kind of story.
It doesn't all have to be about the bug guy.
No, well, that's a story idea off Fair the top enough. Of my head. I don't I work in the writer's room.
All right, and if we did, we'd have more than down. 30 seconds to come up with something.
Yes,
no, indeed. No, I'm not shooting it down. I just want to make sure you're thinking outside that box.
Okay.
I want to encourage you not to... I don't want you to be the guy who's always pitching bug ideas.
But I've just come up with a story that incorporates three of the characters.
There you go. Boom-de-boom. Yeah, so Ghosts of Fear Street aired on July 31st, 1998. That is a Friday... in July in the 90s. That is time slot. Yeah,
so you're not at home.
No one was home. No one gave a crap. It aired after a repeat of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and it aired opposite Candid Camera, which decimated it in the ratings, and something called Getting Personal, which, to be fair, got worse ratings than Ghosts of Fear Street. But it did not do well.
Yeah.
It did apparently okay with the male demographic, but the female demographic left. Like, right, after Sabrina, right. They weren't interested. I guess they marketed it, like, more to young
philosophy.
Young
boys, then, yeah. Well,
and, yeah, just it didn't click.
There's nothing gendered about this. In the 90s...
Again, advertising it can be a factor, though. I don't know how they advertised it.
But, yeah, I mean... Goosebumps wasn't gendered. It was boys and girls were reading Goosebumps books.
I'm just going off of what little information I have about this, and apparently that was the one thing we have definitely is the Nielsen ratings.
Okay.
I actually don't think that's much of a factor, and I think that if the show had been picked up, and if it had consistently aired after Sabrina the Teenage Witch, more people would have given it a try eventually.
Maybe.
Just because they would have left their TV on for a bit, and then they probably would have thought to themselves, if it's all as good as the pilot... It's pretty good, actually. We should keep watching this show. This is fun.
I've seen Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and, you know, it deals with witchcraft and magic, and there's a talking cat on the show, and it's also very friendly. It's a very light, funny show, and it didn't strike me as being particularly odd. It's just sitcom with magic elements in it. It's all very easy to understand and consume. Mm-hmm. This is a weird show. This is with its
show for weird kids.
Bug people and moving on to Fear Street. There's a wonderful shot where the mom and the dad are on the porch discussing something, and in the background, out of focus, like in a Zucker Brothers movie, there's somebody just being attacked by crows.
Yeah.
And they don't notice it. It's just something that's happening in the background.
And it's never talked about again. Yeah. It doesn't pay off later. It's just something that happens on Fear Street, and we mind our own business. Mm. That guy pissed off the crow god, and we're just going to let him do his own thing.
I've always loved gags like that are just sort of like put in the background. There's a wonderful shot. I got to talk to Jim Abrams once. He came to my college to talk about, you know, Airplane and the comedies that he's made. And... there's this wonderful shot in Hot Shots where it's just exposition, where Lloyd Bridges and Kevin Dunn are having a conversation, and they're very steel-faced.
Oh, and you can see out the window.
And you can see out the window in the distance some soldiers doing like their exercises and their drills, and they end up like doing a kick line.
Yeah.
And it's really hilarious, and your eye is drawn straight to it. And Jim Abrams talked about what a nightmare that was to set up just for a background gag, because he has to set the camera in such a way that you can see those people out the window, like hundreds of feet away.
And you got to time it right, which has got to be a pain in the ass.
So all of that was really, really difficult to set up. Worth it, I'd say.
Sure.
But I think that informs a shot or a scene or a mood way better than putting the gag front and center. So that kind of thing... is announcing that Fear Street's going to be a little bit odd. I think this... And I'd say that this would have benefited from, like, maybe a stranger director. We talk about Bone Chillers. Richard Elfman worked on Bone Chillers.
Doesn't get much stranger than Richard
Elfman is a weird guy. He's just a weird person, and I mean that as the highest compliment. This one was directed by Ken Kwapis,
It's Kwapis, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
And he's got an interesting Kwapis career that's sort of like half middle of the road, likable, but not very interesting comedies, like A Walk in the Woods.
Did a Big Miracle.
He's just not that into you.
Yeah, he's done sort
License
of like...
License to Wed.
Did Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
That was a big hit he did. But he actually got to start doing a bit more interesting stuff. One of his first movies was Sesame Street's Follow That Bird. Which is, if you haven't seen it lately, if you've never seen it at all, charming as hell. I recently watched that, like, last year. It holds up really good. Like, it's just really likable. All the puppet work is really wonderful. Mm. It's got a real emotion to it. Like, it's just... was made by kooky people who made a kooky movie, and it's just a delight, that film.
I would think that Ken Kwapis, who has this, who has this knack for making kind of middle-of-the-road things, would bring sort of a little bit more of a, I guess, a mainstream quality to it, something that's a lot more relatable. But this one's odd. It's a little off-kilter. Well, he's bringing his oddballness.
He also works on Eerie, Indiana. Mm-hmm. We did two episodes of that. And he did a movie that I'm very, very fond of called Vibes.
Yeah, I saw Vibes for the first time just recently.
Oh, no shit. Vibes is wonderful. Nobody talks about Vibes, but Vibes is great. Vibes, 1988, Jeff Goldblum and Cyndi Lauper from Girls Just Want to Have Fun fame. They are psychics. They're part of a college research group where they're trying to investigate people who claim to be psychics. And they are enlisted by Peter Falk to find ancient treasure
in Peter Falk.
And like, I think it's Central America, because there's like some giant pyramid that has magical powers and shit. And it ends up becoming this like thing where people get kidnapped at gunpoint and they fall in love. And it's just weird and wonderful and weird.
Because Jeff Goldblum and Cyndi Lauper are legit psychics. The opening scene of Vibes is them at like the Psychic Institute doing things with like reading people's minds and holding objects and that, and being tested, that sort of thing. Jeff Goldblum like works in a museum, so he can like touch an ancient object and just know its past. It's an odd duck vibes. Yeah.
It's like half an adventure movie, half a comedy, half a rom-com, a con artist film.
It runs out of steam hard right at the end. There's a lot of scenes like at the end where they're just sort of standing around on the pyramid.
They just sort of like
it starts very strong.
It starts very strong. It the ending is a little like they didn't really have a great ending for it, but boy. Just Jeff. It turns out Cyndi Lauper, great actor.
She's a very good actor.
She's so damn charming. It's a shame she wasn't in more. Mm-hmm. Like, I know Vibes wasn't a hit, but like, she's really good in it. I would have paid to see her in more movies.
Luckily, we still have Cyndi Lauper because she's Cyndi Lauper, and
she's incredible.
You can buy her records.
And occasionally she'd act more, but like, she just seemed like she was like going for that sort of Madonna, Desperately Seeking Susan kind of career transition vibe, and it didn't really hit for her, and it's a shame because Vibes is cool. Vibe works. But anyway, Fear Street, Ghosts of Fear Street. The movies, instant classic. The show, was it canceled too soon?
I want to see more of this.
This is adorable. I want to see this.
It's sweet, but it's odd, and I like that. Yeah. Maybe it was too much like some of the other things that were already out there. It's like, oh, well, we had Eerie, Indiana. We had Are You Afraid of the Dark? And I think Tales from the Crypt was already off the air at this point.
I think Tales from the Crypt Keeper might have still been on the air, though. Yeah, it had that animated series based on Tales from the Crypt for like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, but for kids. But it was still pervasive. Like, it was still like the 90s were very Tales from the Crypt centered.
Yeah, Tales from the Crypt was like a runaway hit. Like, it inspired a lot. And it inspired a lot that a lot of people don't really talk about anymore. Like, how many fans are there of the TV series Monsters? Or Tales from the Dark Side, for that matter.
Yeah. Or Are You Afraid in the Dark? I think Tales from the Crypt helped blaze a trail and gave that a bit more freedom. I mean, Tales from the Dark Side, but it wasn't that
lurid
big.
Lurid anthology horror was big business in the 90s. Freddy Krueger even had his own TV series.
Ah, yes. Good times.
It wasn't a good TV series, but Freddy had one.
I've actually never seen Freddy's Nightmares.
I've seen, like, an episode.
I think I might have.
He popped a bowling ball, which was weird.
He popped a bowling
ball? Like, Freddy was the Crypt Keeper, and so he would, like, show up and it's like, here's a story, kids. Here's one of my nightmares. And, and in one of those segments, he was bowling. And I remember a segment where he, like, used his claw to pop. Like, he stabbed the bowling ball and deflated like a balloon.
Oh.
Which is something that might happen in a dream, I suppose. It's not exactly scary, but...
No, it's not scary at all, actually.
Like, if you sliced open the ball and it had, like, guts inside or something, that would freak me out.
Anyway, Ghosts of Fear Street's quite good, though.
I did like Ghosts of Fear Street.
Yeah, it's a very, very good show. It's readily available. You can find it pretty easily online. I think a few people have put it, like, on YouTube... now that Fear Street has come out, they realize that people are kind of interested. It's like 21 minutes long, flies right by. If you're nostalgic for that era of like, thank God it's Friday, kind of sitcoms, or you just want to see some kind of kooky in 90s, check it out. It's a treat. Yeah. It's a fun show, and I'm really, really glad that we watched it and that we were able to bring back Cancel Too Soon with something that was such a fun little discovery.
Yeah.
I guess that's it.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else I really wanted to add. It is of its time. It feels of its time. It feels, I have a lot of nostalgia for this period just because this was when I was a teenager, and everybody has that for their teenage years. But despite that, I think this is still a pretty fun watch. I think there's a lot of sort of relatable characters. It's having fun with itself, and I appreciate that.
We forgot to mention something really, really important. The opening credits.
That's maybe not so important.
I think it's worth bringing up. So why don't we?
Actually, the title sequence could have been the thing that sent people out.
It's really because off-putting, actually.
It's this really kind of, I guess it's like this fun organ riff with a lot of like scary laughter in the background. And it's just a bunch of like really horribly animated CGI skeletons bobbing along to this big sort of abstract red background.
Yeah, just dancing skeletons looking real awkward and uncomfortable. And
it's like that's...
With eyes. Like, they've got eyes, which skeletons should not have eyes.
The CGI looked bad even for the time.
Oh, yeah. Most CGI looked bad at the time.
I think they didn't have a title sequence, and they had to come up with one, like, on the cheap real fast.
I would not be surprised if that were the case.
Because it looks like...
Again, this is a failed pilot. This was like... Maybe if people love it, we'll bring it back. But it feels like we spent the money, we have to air it, we'll just throw it in in the middle of summer and get a little advertising money out of it. But anyway, watch the opening credit sequences there. It's a hoot. That is it for Cancel Too Soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back soon. We do love this show. And I think we're going to be a little less formal about what we do. We're just going to try to follow our bliss for a little bit and find some weird stuff.
We still have a lot of videos that people have mailed to us, and we're going to try to cover those as hard as we can.
We are. But I think it's easier for us to sort of glide along here if we...
Take the pressure off a little bit.
Well, I think when you and I discover something existed, or when someone like tells us about the existence of something that we had no idea about, and we get like super jazzed about it, we just want to do that first.
Yeah.
And I think when we do that and we follow our passion for it, the show gets done a little faster. So I think we need to look at a little less as homework and a little bit more like, oh my God, you guys have to see this thing. So it'll be a combination of both, because you never know what you're going to get. You know, it might sound like a great idea, and then it ends up being a chore. Mm-hmm. It might sound like a chore, and end up being the greatest thing ever. You have the whole point of these shows is they failed before anyone gave them a fair shake. So our job is to give them a fair shake. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but we're giving them a little bit more of a look-see than most people ever did. So, that is Canceled Too Soon. Thank you, everybody, once again. If you want to support this show and all of our other shows of the Critically Acclaimed Network, head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows there, shows about every single episode of Star Trek. We're about to start our journey through every single episode of The Next Generation. Very excited. And we've actually just decided that as a treat for everybody, we are going to put our review of the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation on the main feed for free.
Yeah.
Everybody can at least listen to the pilot episode, because I know a lot of people are waiting for us to get to The Next Generation, and we want some people to hear about like what we're doing over there, and maybe they can follow along the rest of our journey. We got that going on. We've got shows about the Academy Awards, every single episode of the 1960s Batman, commentary tracks. You can vote for episodes. Like, there's a lot going on over at our Patreon. So once again, that's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You can also join in the conversation by emailing us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And if you email us, we might answer your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail, where we answer your emails. That's the whole point of that show. Whitney, tell them about our P.O. box.
We have a P.O. box. Mail us something. Mail us a letter. If you mail us a letter on paper, we'll read that on the letters episode. It's P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, hold on. I think my pipes are...
Yeah, if you can hear a humming in the background, yeah, it's a plumbing problem.
I think we got a plumbing problem in our building or something like that, so hopefully it's not too distracting. I don't know. I can't... Maybe you can't hear that, but I certainly can.
You know what? This ties back to fear in the 90s. We had plumbing problems in my childhood home. And there was a period when, before we got the pipes fixed, whenever somebody flushed the toilet, like about a minute later, you could hear the pipes vibrating, and it got really loud right in my bedroom.
Ooh.
And so if my sister used the restroom or something in the middle of the night.
That was the plot point in that horror movie Ghost Watch.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, there was all these mysterious noises, and the mom was telling the
mysterious
kids.
Mysterious noses everywhere.
That's creepy, right? No, there was mysterious noises, and the mom was trying to tell the kids everything's okay. She said, it's okay, it's just pipes. So the kids thought that was the name of the ghost, Pipes. Which is a creepy ghost name if you think about it.
Yeah, really loud, deep humming noise, and I didn't know what it was.
That sounds awful.
Felt like the house was like trying to swallow me.
Super creepy. Anyway, we're also on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And that's a wrap. We'll see you next season. Or on the next podcast that we have on this network. Whichever comes first.